Okay, I was born on the 17th of March, 1915, in High Valley.
Uh-huh.
And my name was Laverne Dick Draper.
Uh-huh.
My dad's name was just Dick.
Uh-huh.
And, I originally, it was Dick Laverne, but they, when I got old enough to vote, they got it all mixed up, and the courthouse suggested that I change and put it Laverne Dick, and that way it didn't mix me up with his dad, but it's my dad.
Yeah.
I grew up here at Union. I was went to school here. I graduated from high school in 1932.
Uh-huh.
In a class of 31. And now there's only about 8 of us left.
You said that your grandfather came here in the early days.
I forgot to dig that out. My grandfather came here in 1862.
Uh-huh.
And he had 1,000 acres in High Valley. And at one time he had a dairy and they made the butter, and I don't know how they stored it so it didn't get rancid, but they hauled it by six-horse team and 2 wagon and peddled it in around the mines up around Cornucopia and then also up around Cooperum and in Idaho.
Did you have an ice house when you were a kid?
Pardon?
Did you have an ice house? Did they
No.
cut ice? I thought maybe that
No.
they might have done that.
When, by the time I was a kid, see, Dad, well, after Granddad had the dairy, then he had a bunch of sheep, and my dad, when he was younger, was more or less a camp tender, and that was all gone when all he had was, Granddad had was cattle and the ranch in High Valley, and then he had about, I think it was 240 acres of timberland on the breaks of Little Catherine.
Oh.
And that was, he was more or less just running the ranch up there in High Valley with the cattle and stuff like that, but as far back as I can remember.
And then your father took over after?
Well, no. Dad and, see, Granddad, my dad's mother died.
Uh-huh.
And, then Granddad married again, and she only lasted a year. And then he married the third time, and Dad would never put out very much, but there was some friction there somewhere. And we moved to Union in 1919. We used to live down in the Gulch, what they called the Gulch, below Granddad's place, in a little old boxcar-like house. And
how old were you at that time?
4.
4. So when you started to school, you started in Union?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Did you go to the Mayfield School?
No. See, my folks were strict Seventh-day Adventists.
Oh.
And they used to have a private school, and it was right there where the parking lot of the Mormon church is.
Oh.
And the Adventist church was on the corner next to Elm.
Uh-huh.
And then the schoolhouse sat behind it. And I went through the 8th grade there. And then, of course, the Depression was on, and Dad wouldn't send me to the Jim State Academy, which is a Seventh-day Adventist school in Caldwell, but we didn't have the money.
Uh-huh.
And I went to the high school here at Union when I was a freshman. I was 13, and I graduated when I was 17. I was the youngest boy in the class and the smallest boy in the class. The night I graduated, I didn't weigh 100 pounds and I wasn't 5 feet tall. And old Clark Cadwell said, "I got a little guy here for his last diploma." And I was the last one in the class to get on my diploma. I began to figure I wasn't going to get one until. And old Claude put his arm around me, and I used to shovel snow for him. I'd clean his sidewalks for a quarter, and that's the way I bought my school supplies, shoveling snow for him. He had the hardware,
yeah.
And I'd clean the sidewalk in front of the hardware, and And it was this big square white house right across from the Methodist Church. And
you ended up to be 6'3", though.
I'm 6'3", and at one time I weighed 240 pounds.
So you grew after you got out of high school. Well, what did you do while you were going to high school? Any outstanding thing?
No, I wasn't big enough to be in any of the games or athletics. I was too small. Sometimes I was water boy for the football team, but that was about it. But just normal school activities. I did play in the trumpet in the high school orchestra.
And you said when you were in high school, you used to bellhop at Hot Lake?
It was after I graduated.
Oh, after you graduated.
Yeah, see, I graduated in 32. I forgot when old W.T. Fye died, and then his son, Mark, took over. And they had a guy there by the name of McPherson. And he was a Seventh-day Adventist. And he used to come to the church here at Union. And one Saturday night, he come to the house, and you couldn't find a job, but doing hardly anything. And he asked me if I wanted to go to work. And I said, yeah, you bet. And he said, well, pack your suitcase. And he said, I'd like for you to work as a bellhop to help clean the lobby and help in the bathhouse and meet the trains and put the mail on the train and carry luggage and stuff like that. And I worked over there, I think it's about 3 or 4 months. And then, things started going to pot and they started laying off. And then I got a job working it for an old orchardist here that by the name of Weaver, that he had a prune and cherry orchard. And I started working for him, and I worked for him until I went to work on the railroad.
And the first job you had on the railroad was working on the section?
Yeah, I went to work on the section on the 26th of December in 1936. And the snow at I went to Telecasset. And the highway was about to the top of the hill at Telecasset, and then it was plugged from there the rest of the way to North Powder. And I worked for a Japanese section foreman, George Kobayashi. And he was as nice a guy to work for. He never got rough on any of the men. He'd say, well, come on, boys, let's do it this way. And he was just as nice a guy to work with as you had ever worked with. He had a real bad blizzard where they plowed the snow off the track. It looked like a canal with two silver streaks down it where the rails were. The snow was right even with the bottom cross arm on the telegraph pole. And in those days they had a helper station at Telecasset. And they had a coal chute and a water tank. And where we had dug out the switches for them to turn the helper engines on the Y, we run out of a place to pile snow, and the railroad sent a clamshell out there with a bunch of gons, and they loaded 6 gons of snow from right around the depot, so we have a place to pile more snow.
Yeah, the gons are gondolas.
Yeah. I don't know how much snow they had them just heaped up. I guess they hauled them off somewhere and just let them set and let the snow melt out of it. But that was the way they got rid of some of the snow. And then one afternoon in a blizzard, you couldn't see 20 feet in front of you. And another fellow by the name of Red, can't remember his last name. We called him Red anyway. He and I were supposed to clean the west switch of Telecasset to let the snow plow out. Well, plowing down in the storm, They missed the derail and shoved the dozer over the derail and derailed the front wheels. And we had, in those days, they had a re-railing frog, what they called a re-railing frog, and it had sharp points on the bottom edge, but when they were put in place, they had to be spiked down with a track spike, and one of them had to be in underneath the wheel underneath to guide the wheel back on the rail. And we worked out there. Well, we ate our lunch and didn't have any more lunch. And we worked there getting that thing back on the track about for over about 24 to 30 hours. Uh-huh. And there was the train crews could only work so long on account of the federal law. And they exchanged the crews out there, and there was a conductor had come out that was my first wife's aunt's husband. His name was Bill Driscoll. And old George told another guy and I to go in the caboose and get warm and dry our gloves and try to get dried off a little bit. And old Bill said, "Vern, what in the world are you doing walling around out there like a damned hog in the snow? Why don't you, if you want to work on the railroad, why don't you go to train service?" And I said, "I didn't know how to get in, Bill." So he was the one that helped me, and I talked to George. He gave me a transfer from maintenance away to transportation service. And I hired out on the road in February of 1937, the 21st.
And that was your employment date, which was very important to railroaders.
Oh, yeah.
Because you work on seniority.
Well, my seniority date was established the 13th of March, 1937.
Uh-huh.
And then they got another slump, and I was cut off. I was on the board, I got up second out, and got cut off. And I couldn't work again until the summer of 39. And I worked around for ranchers, driving cat, and whatever job I could find. When I got cut off the railroad in 39, I went to work for Bert Shelton in the logging camp, driving cats, and then the grease monkey. I worked at Pondoso. That was when Pondoso was still a very active mill, and they had a big Gipple contract out there off the Thief Valley Highway back up. I think they called it Fisher's Place back in there, and I had four V8 cats and six trucks to take care of, and grease and service and fuel up.
Can you explain to the people that don't know what a gypo is?
The gypo is he's a guy, more or less a contractor that he'll bid. They bid on a job of and for so logging for so much, and it was on an estimated scale. And the logs were all figured on a scale.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a guy that they called the scaler. They called that scaling stick a gypo stick, because it just gave more or less a rough estimate. It was fairly close, but a lot of times the logs wouldn't saw out, or maybe they'd saw out a little more than what this scale, depending on the length of it, and there was markings on there. I think they started at 8 feet. Let's see, it was 8, 10, 12, and 16, I think. In those days, most all logs were 16. They were cut 16 feet, 6 inches, so that they could, when the logs went through, the lumber went through the mill, and went through the edger and took the bark off, then when it went out on the green chain, they had saws that would cut it exactly 16 feet.
Uh-huh.
And so the contractor that got the job of logging that area and getting it in was called a gypo. I worked for him until he shut down, and then in those days, they didn't deck the logs out. They started that year. That was in 39. or 40, and early in the 40. Then I got called back to road in July of 41, and I worked, I think it was 6 weeks, and got cut off again. And I was cut off 2 weeks and got called back, and I went to work, and then I got assigned to, as the younger men came on the board, they had assigned us to an outside point, and I got assigned to Reese, switching, Reese Pendleton. And I switched in the Reese Pendleton yard from the latter part of August of 40 till, I think it was February or March of 41 before I had seniority enough to get back to the grant.
When there was a crew, how many, there was a conductor and how many brakemen on a crew?
Well, on a full crew on the main line, there was a conductor and three brakemen. There was a flagman and two brakemen. In those days, whenever a train stopped, if it wasn't in the passing track, the flagman had to, the rules were that a flagman would go back and protect the rear end of the train. And he'd go back a half a mile and put two torpedoes, which was a little piece of powder in a clip that clipped on the rail. And then if he wasn't recalled by his engine, why, he'd proceed on back another three-quarters of a mile and put two more torpedoes. Then he could return to the first torpedoes that he put and wait there until relieved or called in by an engine. And the way the engineers called them in, if the flagman was out toward the east, the railroad went east and west. And if the flagman went out to the east, why, the engineer would call him in with five long blasts of the whistle. If he went to the west, they'd call him in with four long blasts of the whistle. And they said the reason for that was there was more people in the east than there was in the west, so that they whistled more to get them to come in from the east. And there was it was an interesting job. I worked as a flagman quite a bit. In handling the trains off the hill from Camila toward Pendleton and Camila this way, we used to use what was a retaining valve to help the engineer maintain the constant air pressure. And it held 10 pounds of air against the brake cylinder, so that if the engineer had to release his brakes to recharge the train line, he still had some brake against the train to stabilize the speed until he could make another application. We used to stop at Meacham and Cool Wheels in 10 minutes, and then at a passing track called Huron, 7 miles down the track in Cool Wheels. One night in a snowstorm, they whistled me out, and whenever they'd stop, when they wanted to protect the rear end of the train, the engineer would whistle one long blast of the whistle and then three short ones. And that was the signal to protect the rear end of the train. And I went out and about five to 10 minutes, depending on if they looked the train over and everything was all right, why, usually we'd go again in 10 minutes. And they called me in, and when I turned to come in, I left, there was a helper coming down the hill behind us, and I left two torpedoes and a lighted red fusee on the track. When I lit the fusee, I saw a flash of some eyes down the track toward the caboose. As I had a little white lantern that I could see it was an animal, so I lit another fusee and throwed it at it. When I got down there, this cougar had come around the back of the train and walked in my tracks, followed me clear out, and it was about 30, 40 feet behind me when I stopped to put the torpedoes on the track. And I threw the fusee at it, and it jumped out of the track and went down into Meacham Creek. And I looked at the track where he stepped in my track, and I could lay the palm of my hand right in his track and see the print of his track all the way around my hand.
He was a big cook.
And when I got back to the caboose, I hollered at the conductor. I said, the conductor was Denny Doherty. I said, hey, Denny, come here. I want to show you something. Oh, what do you want? And I said, get down here for it. Give him a highball. I want to show you something. Well, when he got down, we looked out on the side of the train from the where the track. This cougar had come up along the side of the train, stopped at the step of the caboose, and then walked right around the caboose in between the rails and followed my tracks out when I was went flagging.
We'll do that.
And it was on middle of the night, and I was never scared or anything. I got left down there several times, but that was one time that I actually saw the animal when I throwed a light of red UV at him.
Now, what year was this?
Oh, probably in 46, 47. Uh-huh. It was while we still had steam engines.
Yeah.
I think we got the steam diesels in 52, I think. 51 or 52, I don't remember.
When you came back to the railroad and started working all the time, this was when the war was starting, and you were moving a lot of freight at that time.
Well, yeah.
Is that correct?
And a lot of passengers.
Troop trains and equipment.
Equipment, and then a lot of just trains that were troops. Mm-hmm. And business picked up. Every trip was a 16-hour trip. It didn't make much difference. You just figured when I got called, why it would be 16 hours before you got to the other end of the line. We worked by train order. The dispatcher had some main trains. He'd move them as best he could. Maybe we'd set in the passing track for 3 or 4 hours sometimes, waiting for traffic, opposing traffic to go by.
And you'd get a slip of paper called the lineup.
Yeah.
Can you tell me what the lineup, so that people will know?
And the dispatcher would, the chief dispatcher would get a deal out of Omaha or out of Pocatello this way, the number of trains they were going to run in the day. And each train was designated by a number or a symbol. And this lineup would be like the westbound trains would be 257. 267, end in an odd number, and there would be maybe two sections or three sections of that train, which would be a manifest, maybe a manifest train. And then the others would be drags, maybe military equipment. And the lineup would show the consist of what was in the train and approximately how many trains they were going to run. And it give a, we worked on a first-in and first-out deal. And it would give us some idea of when we were going to work, but you could just about figure if you was home, if you 16 hours, we got 10 hours at home. If we got in less than 16 hours, we usually got called in 8.
And a hot train was usually one that they run around the other trains.
Yeah,
because
they hold the other trains, and then the merchandise train or the hot shot, or the highballs, they call them, would be run first. Passenger train was a first-class train, and all trains had to be in the clear by the time that last, at least 10 minutes of the last time on the schedule that was shown.
That would be the passenger train.
Yeah, except the streamliner, and you had to be in the clear 25 minutes, which was number one and number two in those days. And they... the number one and number two made 5 round trips between Chicago and Portland a month. And when if you delayed them, you had better have a pretty good alibi or reason, or you usually had to climb the stairs and tell them why.
Usually if an accident happened, they fired everybody in sight and then decided who was wrong and who was right.
Yeah.
Did you like working for the railroad?
I did at first. It was very interesting. I enjoyed the old steam engines. I really enjoyed riding on them. They were noisy. They were dirty. And a lot of them, they were still, some of them were still hand-fired engines, some of the mics, when I went to work in 37. My problem was I always worked with a shovel right-handed, and that put my rear end over in the engineer, and he didn't like that. He wanted me to turn the other way, and I couldn't hit the fire door with the shovel.
Well, did the brakeman have to shovel?
Oh, we did. Uh-huh. The fireman would run out of, he'd have to take a break and work on going up the hill. You'd throw a shovel full of coal in and it'd go poof, poof, and it was gone. Uh-huh. And it wasn't anything to go through 13 or 14 ton of coal from Union to Tallahassee. And then we'd have to take coal and everything on some of the engines up there. Some of the engines had stokers on them, some of them didn't. But the stokers would just pile the coal up in the back of the firebox, and then the fireman would have to take a big, long poke and break that pile down and push it to the, around in the firebox so that it would even heat and keep the steam up. Otherwise, why, if they got too much piled up back there, why, the, it wouldn't keep, it wasn't hot enough to keep the steam up.
We, a question was asked when we were going up on the Mount Emily line here recently about what a Mallee was. Can you, a Mallee?
A Mallee is two engines in one. See, the Mallees, the original Mallees were, they called them sleds. They were, the front engine was a scavenger engine. The hot steam went to the back engine, and then when the cylinders on the back engine exhausted, it would exhaust into a chamber for the front engine. And the cylinders on the front engine was about 1.5 times the size of the ones on the back engine. And about 35 to 40 miles an hour was their top speed.
That's what would run the drivers.
Huh?
That would run the drivers.
Yeah, yeah. And they claimed that was cold steam that was running the front drivers, the reason that the cylinders, and they had a valve, or a, well, it was kind of like a throttle. If they needed a little more steam in the front, why, they'd open that valve, and it was called a blue goose. The valve was usually painted blue, and as I remember, they had converted most of those old sleds, as they called them, oil burners by the time I went to work. And when they converted them, they called it, as they said, they simpled the engine. It was hot steam to both the front engine and the back engine. The front engine was on an oscillating plate, so that the engine's going around a curve. The front engine would turn under the front of the engine, and the boiler would still stick out straight. And as it come around the curve, well, then this oscillating plate, the engine would go back and line up with the boiler for on the straight and level track. Most of them was what they called 2-4 or 2880 type engine, which was two pony trucks, four drivers, and nothing, no trailing trucks behind, usually to get the tanks. Then when the 3800s came here, they were...
And that was the size of the engine.
Yeah, the size of the... The other engines were 3500 series. Uh-huh. Then the 3800, the 3500s had 51-inch drivers, and I think the drive wheels, the main, where the cylinders were to run the engine. The 3800s was... I think they were either 66... or 72-inch. 66, I think they were. 5.5 feet. And they carried, the old engines carried about, 190, 200 pounds of steam. And then when the 3800s come, they carried 320 pounds of steam. Some of them did, some of them weren't quite that much steam. But, they were a faster engine than the 3500.
They kept getting bigger, didn't they?
Yeah.
In until finally they came out with a 9,000, wasn't it?
Well, the 9,000, they had them, but they were all on the short line. They were too rigid to run on these curves. See, we had too many curves. It was 8 and 10 degree curves, especially between here and Huntington and also west of La Grande. And they were a 4.10-4, I believe. And they were a scavenger engine. They had the third cylinder. They had three cylinders. And the middle, the front drive shaft was just like a big crank. And the center cylinder set right up even with the front of the boiler out in front. And they were a real rigid engine. And they did run them in here a time or two, but it knocked all the curves out and knocked the gauge of the track out, and they had to re-gauge a lot of the track.
What was about the biggest size that they could run?
The 3,800. 3,800. They tried to bring in 4,000, and that was the big boy that worked out of Cheyenne. That was the biggest steam engine made. And they got it to Huntington, and they didn't have any problem getting it to Huntington. But when they started to come west to Huntington, it wouldn't go through the tunnel at Weatherby. And air pumps and everything was out on the front of the engine. And the front of it was a 4.884 type engine. And if I remember right, that's an 8-degree curve in the tunnel there at Weatherby. So they come out there and they started through, and they had an official riding on the running board to see. And they got about halfway into the tunnel, and the front engine oscillated, but the boiler wouldn't, and they didn't have clearance enough to go on through, and they had to back out. Then they had to build a special track Y at Huntington to get the thing turned around so it could go back to the short line. But that was the only time that they ever brought a 4,000 here. The 39,000s were, I think they were 81-inch drivers. They used them on passenger, like Portland Rose, until they brought the 800s. They call it the 844 now, 8444 now. And it had 81-inch drivers on it, and it was a 484 type engine. And I was on a Cherry train one time with John Ward pulling with the 8400 and going across Baker Flat. Boy, I clocked him 102 miles an hour. That the engine was just riding like a rocking chair, just bobbing along like that. He started slowing down, about 5 or 6 miles out of Baker to get slowed down so he could take water at Baker.
Well, there was some very, mighty interesting things happened to the railroad as it changed. After the World War II, business continued, and you had a steady job.
Oh, yeah. Well, see, the way things went, I was the youngest 37 man. And in those days, you had to have 5 years to be promoted to a conductor. Well, I don't know what it is now. Well, when they promoted to conductor, they promoted down, including me. And that was in 1942. And when I come, and then the passenger train business had picked up, the war business and everything. There were so many passengers that one conductor couldn't handle it all. A passenger coach was supposed to seat 48 people. And after I learned a little bit about the conductor work, a lot of times we'd have 60 and 70 people in one car. And when I came out of the rule car.
Now explain the rule car to them, please.
The rule car was a car that went through And each one of us had to take the Book of Rules examination every 2 years, which included all the rules in the book. And then they had an air brake car for engineers and firemen, but the trainmen and conductors also had to take an examination. It only usually lasted about an hour. The rules car, they usually two sessions. One was on the Book of Rules and one was on train orders. And they'd throw a train order at us, and then it requires to explain what we could do with that train order if we could make a certain station or if we'd have to stay in a certain station. They had a projector that they'd throw a schedule on a screen, and this train wait until so-and-so. Well, if you had a train that was superior and it put out a time that it would wait, say at Hot Lake, to a certain time, if it wasn't there, if you were in the passing track at Hot Lake, when that time come up, if that train wasn't there, you sat there because that time was up and you couldn't leave. So in the rules car, they went into all that to find out, to make sure that the train crews and engineers all understood how to read and interpret the orders and what they could do and what they couldn't do on it. When I come out of the rule car, the crew dispatcher said, the train master wants to see you upstairs. And I thought, oh boy, now what have I done? So I went up there, and when I walked in, old Ben Johnson was the assistant superintendent. He said, Draper, you want to be a passenger conductor? And I said, well, I tried to learn what I could as I hired out here. I guess if I had a chance, I can learn it. No, he said, we'll fix it so you can learn it. He said, you're assigned as a ticket conductor on the passenger train. And they gave me a letter. I was to make two trips with a guy by the name of Mahoney that was on the Portland Road, and he handled the Pullman section of the train. I was to make two trips with Mel Galbraith that was on the train, the coach section, and learn the coach work. And then I was to make one round trip on the Streamliner, and I had to make nine trips altogether. He said, you put out, make a time slip just like you were working. When you complete it, bring your letter and the time slips to me and I'll okay them. And then I went to work as started out on what they call the Idahoan. It came out of Pendleton at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And I'd work it till we met Second 17, which was the coach section of the Portland Road. Wherever we met, they had to stop and let me off to get on the other train, and then I'd work back to Pendleton. Well, that didn't work out too good because it took all the time for two conductors to check a train, even leaving Huntington, because you had to check every passenger going into Pendleton on account of Pendleton was a division point. And there was many soldiers and our sailors and soldiers. See, Walla Walla had an army base. Pendleton had an army base. And then Farragut had the Navy base. And we had to make sure that everybody was checked, and anybody going to Spokane or up that way got their ticket back. And we had to check every passenger and make sure that they got several times. I found passengers that was riding in the ladies' lounge or the men's lounge that their ticket didn't even have a punch mark in it, and they'd come all the way from St. Louis or Kansas City on the train and they'd never been checked. But we had to check every one. Mm-hmm. So then they changed it, and I got assigned the first job was what we called 26 out of Pendleton or the Idahoan to Huntington, and then the 25 back to Pendleton. And many of the time I punched the last ticket going into by the hospital at Pendleton, and then I'd have to sit in the trainman room for maybe 45 minutes or an hour making my passenger count and report to go to Omaha. And it was really a workout. And the older men conductors got off from it because it was tough. And they could make a little more money on freight at the rate of pay then. And freight was turning, and wherever trip was a 16-hour trip, why, they was making the maximum amount that they could make every trip. So I got on, I was assigned a passenger. Well, I was single, and I got reclassified with the draft board for 1A. So I thought when I'd been cut off the road where I drove cat and drove truck, why, they were starting the CBs, and I could get in the CBs and get a pretty good rating out of it. So I laid off and went to Portland. They didn't have a recruiter at Pendleton. And I went to Portland to the Navy, and they said, well, yeah, you bet, but you got to be cleared through your draft board. Well, when they classified you, they had to, the draft board had to notify your employer. And the draft board notified the railroad that I was put in 1A. Well, where I was working on passenger, and I worked steady. I didn't lay off. I hardly ever laid off. I was taught when you went on a job, you worked the job, and that's the way I always tried to work. So the Navy said, well, you'll have to be probably 8-10 days before you know whether you get to go or not. Well, I came home and tried to set things up so I could go. And I got a card from the draft board, 4A for the duration with no reclassification. I still got the card in my desk in there. And the Navy turned me down, and so...
Well, you were needed in the war effort.
Huh?
You were needed in the war effort.
Yeah. I was froze to the job on passenger. And so I worked as a passenger conductor for, about 3 years. Three and a half years till the war was over anyway.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, then when the war was over, boy, that broke that freeze. But I couldn't hold anything but chain gang freight as a brakeman. And I couldn't bid off the passenger job as a conductor back to a brakeman job. So I was stuck there till they cut me off of that, and then I bumped back in on into the chain gang.
Now, tell them about bumping. Tell them about bumping. That's where seniority comes in.
To bump, you place yourself on some job younger that a younger seniority man was on. And like when I got cut off, I checked the board, and I couldn't hold the branch job, so I couldn't bump on there. Whatever, you selected the job that you wanted to try to get on. And then if you had seniority, you made application to be put on there, and they called it bumping.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what some people don't understand. And so
yeah.
Seniority was a very important thing for you to continue working.
Seniority and time was the most important thing on the railroad.
Now, there's another thing that we haven't mentioned. Everybody carried a railroad watch.
And the watch... My watch was a 992 Hamilton. I still have it. I carried it for 41 years. And a railroad watch in those days, the time was dispatched from Naval Observatory in Washington at 12 o'clock noon. And they had standard clocks in all the stations that this National Observatory would electrically set the clocks at 12 o'clock Washington, D.C., or 9 o'clock here. When we went to work, we had to check our watch with the standard clock and sign on the register that we had checked our watch, and it was within 10 seconds of the in the standard time. At every 50, they had a watch, a designated watchmaker. Jack Pear was the designated watchmaker.
In LeGrand.
In LeGrand. I got my watch from him. Every 15 days, we had to go in and sign a slip in there and have him check our watch. And he had a standard clock in there that set, get the same as the railroad clock did. And he'd check our watches over and make sure that they were within 10 seconds of the standard clock. And we had to sign this slip. If we missed a 15-day watch check, it was 30 demerit marks, and if you got too many demerit marks, you might get pulled out of service, or they'd take some off so they could give you some more. I lucked out. I only got one 30 set of 30 demerit marks, and I'd been on a work train, and I couldn't get into any place to have my watch checked. Yeah, but when I explained where I was, why then I had to go upstairs and tell the train master where I was, but they pulled the demerit marks off. But everybody's watch was within 10 seconds because time and schedules was all, time on the railroad was a very important thing. And if your watch was off and you missed one of those weights or meets that had a time weight on it or didn't get clear for a passenger train, why, you could get pulled out of service.
Well, during the war, did you experience any difficulty with rationing? How did that affect you?
No. Oh, there was a lot of stuff that was scarce. Of course, I was single, and I ate in a restaurant most of the time then, and it didn't have much of an effect on me. You couldn't go into a restaurant and order a steak or anything like that. Usually you got fish or maybe once in a while some chicken or something like that. But the restaurants all had a lot of fish for some reason or other. But,
In shoes? Shoes were rationed?
You had to go to the ration board and get a slip to get shoes. And you had to, like, where I was on pasture, I had to wear dress shoes all the time. They had to be polished and everything. Like, to get dress shoes sometimes was kind of a problem. You'd have to go to the draft board and get that.
You had a car and you were allowed about how much gas?
5 gallons of gas a month, I think, something like that. I had an A stamp. And I just parked my car most of the time. I could find once in a while somebody have a little extra gas and get a little bootleg gas. I didn't have time to use it for anything else because
working very steady.
Yeah. Many times I've seen Idaho and going into Pendleton, I've held as high as maybe between 400 and 500 through tickets, in addition to the tickets that I'd give back and the cancellations for people that got off and got on and run. We used to haul a lot of people down in the canyon. They didn't have gasoline, and they'd ride the train out to the Grand for supplies. We'd pick them up. Some of them had passes. I had to make a record of all the passes. I got turned in one time for carrying people without proper transportation. When I first went to work on pasture, I was working with an old-time conductor. And he said, Vern, I'm going to give you a few pointers to cut your work down. He said, officials and section men and water service gang, people that ride the train all the time, get their pass number and mark it down in your book. When they get on to go, like, service the water down in the canyon, where they tell you where they want to get off, you'd get hat check them for, like, Huron or Meacham or Duncan or Gibbon or wherever they were going.
That's between LeGrand and Pendleton.
Between LeGrand and Pendleton. Mm-hmm. Or the other way, it wasn't so much, well, we stopped at Union Junction, North Powder, Haines, Baker, and sometimes at Durkee. It was a flag stop. And old Box had just put their pass down, and then when they get on, why, you know who they are, and just when you get to your desk and can sit down, why, then you can just take the number out of your book and put it on your passenger report where they were going, and it saves you a lot of time in out in the car, and you can get to your desk maybe and sit down and do a lot of it. Well, there was an operator got on at LeGrand. She'd been partying and didn't get a pass back to Huntington. I was going east on 26. If she had come to me out on the platform and said that I didn't get a chance to get a ticket or a pass, I would have taken her. She waited till she got in the car with a car full of people, and as I checked, she said, "You'll have to carry me. I didn't have a chance to get a pass, and you'll just have to carry me to Huntington." Well, anything like that, that was putting me right up against the blaze, because I was responsible to make sure that everybody had the proper transportation. And I said, "Well, then you'll just have to pay a cash fare," because she got mad. There was a roundhouse foreman in there, and he said, "Well, you can carry her on my pass as my wife." And I said, "Your pass doesn't have your wife's name on it." See, there was A passes and B passes. Mm-hmm. An A pass was for a semi-official, and it was for him alone. A B pass could cover the employee or his family. And it was good on some trains, some of the trains it wasn't. An A-pass was good on any train because it was an official. He said, "You can carry her on my pass." And I said, "Mister, your A-pass isn't good for her to ride." And I made her pay a cash fare because she put me right up against it. Well, she turned me in. The train master's name was Bruner. So I went to work at Pendleton, and here Bruner was down there, and he followed me through the train, just watched every move I made, rode all the way to Huntington with me. And I didn't know I'd been turned in. So another thing that old Bob taught me was when you picked up some local tickets, keep an extra one in your pocket once in a while, and then if you got in a tight spot, you had something to show. So I always had maybe two or three tickets, but I made sure I turned them in before the expiration date on to have an alibi in case I got caught. Well, he counted every passenger, and when I got into Huntington, he wanted to know what my passenger count was. But when I gave it to him, I had a record of tickets I'd punched and cash fares and everything. I don't remember, but I exceeded what he had counted on the train. And he didn't say anything about me being turned in. So the next day when I got called for 25 to go back, here he was right down there, and he followed me all the way through to get back the tickets and to check. See, the old Idahoan had three Pullman cars, in addition to usually 8 to 10 passenger cars. And a conductor had to cut what they were called was an exchange check. Now, you take a ticket on a passenger train, there was local tickets and interline tickets. A local ticket was one that was issued on Union Pacific, just over the Union Pacific line. an interline ticket with a ticket that was maybe covered two or three lines. Like they come out of Kansas City on Norfolk and Western. And then rode the Rock Island from Kansas City to Denver, or maybe some other train. And then Union Pacific, Denver to Seattle, or someplace north of Portland. Well, we had to cut this exchange check on that coupon that was on an interline ticket so that Union Pacific would get their revenue, like from Denver to Portland, because there was the Great Northern, Northern Pacific, and in addition to Union Pacific running out of Portland to Seattle. But these extenders, we called them, were good on any of the trains. It was a ticket, just the same, only it was an exchange, and there was a coupon on the back that we stapled to the other coupon and sent it in to the auditor. Well, Miss Bruner didn't understand why I was cutting those X-10s. He didn't know anything about that. So when we got LeGrand, why, I unloaded a lot of people, and then I knew most of the people that went, like, down to Huron and Duncan and Gibbon toward Pendleton, down there where they couldn't get out except on the train. And they'd have their groceries and stuff, so I'd load them first. Then if I had any room, I'd take through passengers. And I had a bunch of water service gang, and I'd come through, and they told me where they wanted, and I just had checked them and went on about it. Coming into Pendleton, why, he said, have you got a minute to talk? Oh, I said, I guess so. Why? Well, he said, let's wait till we get off of Pendleton. So he said, you was turned in for carrying passengers that didn't have proper transportation. He said, you never asked me for my pass. I said, I've got your pass. He looked at me so funny, and I took my book out of my coat pocket, and I said, here's your pass, A number so-and-so. I forgot what his initial was, Bruner. And he stood there and looked at me, and he said, how about a certain one, like going to Duncan? Oh, here's his pass number. And I put it on what they call the 3618, the passenger report. Well, he said, I don't know how you've done it. And I had three or four on there that night that didn't have any ticket, but I knew them. So I had little tickets in my pocket to cover for them. And when I got off at Pendleton, he said, I don't know what your system is, he said, you have got more people on the train than I counted. I said, did you count all those that got off at Pendleton, that I gave them their tickets back? Well, I didn't understand why you were giving their tickets back. I said, they're getting off at Pendleton. They may ride a bus out of Pendleton, they may ride a passenger train, maybe they'll ride a car. So what? That's their ticket. He said, oh, forget it, Vern. He said, just go ahead the way you are, he said. And I don't remember, I had either three or four that was on there that didn't have any transportation. But I was ahead. I knew what I was doing.
Yes.
And so that I could cover up and make everything work out all right. Another time I went through, it's kind of funny. I cut an X-10 and I went back to the Pullman's, and this lady was sitting there playing cards with a group. And so I walked up to her and I said, are you going to Seattle? She said, yes, I am. I said, if you'll give me your claim check, I'll give you your ticket from Portland to Seattle. Well, that's all right, young man. You tell the conductor to come back, and I'll give him my claim check, and he can give me back the ticket. And I said, well, lady, I am the conductor. And she reared back and looked at me, and she said, you, a young whippersnapper like you, a passenger conductor? Why, passenger conductors are old, grouchy old men with a big, fat belly.
Ha, ha, ha.
But it was a rough game. Then when they pulled the passenger trains off, well, I went to, after the war, when I got seniority enough, I went on the Joseph branch. That was a branch line from La Grande to Joseph. It was a local run. And I was out there about 8 years, I guess. And then when they changed that around, I went to Portland on passenger in December of 60. And, of course, I just got put back to work. I had a derailment at Meacham early in the spring of 60. And I got fired because I cut the helper in wrong, derailed the car, and we re-railed it and didn't delay anybody. But I still, because I was the conductor, I got
pulled out. That was one of those times that they fire everybody and and then sort things out.
In the meantime, I had learned to fly. I learned to fly as a hobby, something I always wanted to do. And the fellow that taught me to fly, he and I got to be real good friends. He was one of them that pioneered the air tanker service to fight forest fire.
Mm-hmm.
He had bid on some war surplus B-25s at Davis-Mollison Field in Tucson.
And what was his name?
His name was Eldon Down. Mm-hmm. Eldon and I got to be real good friends, and we were out elk hunting together. And he said, he taught me to fly. I'll have to tell a little incident on that. I got about half scared to death. I was about ready to quit. He soloed me in 4 hours and 45 minutes. Most student pilots learning to fly, it takes at least 8 to 9 hours before they're qualified to land and take an airplane off. We'd been out. The way he taught me why I was flagging for him. I got pulled out of service. No, I'd broke an arm. I had an accident, broke an arm. And he said, when I went to get my student permit, I told him I couldn't learn to fly then. Oh, he said, get your permit in hand. So the FAA was here, and I got my permit. In those days, it was still an air identification zone between here and Pendleton on the account of Haddonford, and you had to have a government card with your picture and your fingerprints on it, and I still have one of them.
Cool.
And so after I got my student permit and my